Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. I can't help noticing that we're in the East End again this week. We were in the East End the last couple of weeks, and in fact, we seem to have started to move in a tight little circle around the Whitechapel, Bow, Roman Road area. Completely accidental, I promise. If you're so inclined, you can start laying your bets on which part of town we're going to be in next week. Before we get underway, a quick shout out to Glenn Hodge, Accessible Joe on Twitter, top marks as well to Adam Wilson, who has gone the extra mile and installed a Londonist lock screen on his phone. And I want to say hello as well to the exquisitely monikered Alex Chidley Utley, who tweets, I am engulfed by N. Quentin Wolfe and his Londonist podcast series, currently listening to Dead in the Water en route to Chester. Can one be engulfed by someone and their podcast series? I suppose so. Why not? But that episode came out a couple of years ago, so there's a lot of catching up to do. I'm going to hedge my bets and say happy 2018, Alex. Meanwhile, back in the present and inevitably in the East End, I offer you this week's show.
Hey, baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds. You ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door.
Hello, as late autumn, early winter days go, this is simply stunning. Blue sky as far as the eye can see. Well, that's not true as far as the eye can see. Upwards, as far as the eye can see. Towering above us are several towers, and they're going to form at least part of what we're talking today. The gold lettering of the Cranbrook Estate here in the East End is glinting in the sunshine. Also glinting in the sunshine, John Boughton, author of the Municipal Dreams blog. Hi.
Hi, good to meet you.
Likewise. And, well, what a day. This is cracking, isn't it?
It's beautiful, yeah. I was a bit worried about having an outside recording, but I think we chose well.
Quite so. And there are seagulls around, which I think, doesn't that mean that there's trouble at sea? You wouldn't know it here. People feeding the pigeons just down there. I'm not sure I approve of that. I'm not going to ask you to comment. should we go and stand next to the people feeding the pigeons and then comment on the people feeding the pigeons?
Sure.
you're game for that. No, I'm not going to put you through. Municipal Dreams, let's start there. What is what's your blog about?
Well, it's a blog about the pioneering achievements and reforms of local government. It has a strong focus on what I still call council housing, because council housing has been probably the most significant innovation of local government over the last 120-odd years. It's made a massive difference to people's lives. I think it's a neglected topic. It's an important topic, obviously, in terms of the current housing crisis. So my task, I suppose, is to take a sort of hopefully a fairly unblinkered, fairly realistic, but also a celebratory look at what council housing has achieved.
Yeah, that's remarkable. As soon as you brought that up, I realised that I'm well aware of the origins of, for example, the NHS, but it's only you saying that that's made me realise I know nothing about when council housing started, or I can just about imagine why, but it's much less trumpeted.
Yeah, well, it goes back to 1890. It goes back to the Housing of the Working Classes Act of 1890, and in a London context, it goes back to the Well, actually, first of all, to the Richmond Borough Council, which was then in Surrey, my claim is that Manor Grove in Richmond is the first completed council housing in what is now London. But when we talk about London, obviously, and talk about council housing, we really think about the London County Council. London County Council itself was formed in 1890, and we're not too far away from the Boundary Estate, which was the first major project completed by the LCC in 1900.
And when we think of council housing, what we don't think of is Richmond, of course.
We don't, but Richmond had its share of slums and very dilapidated working class housing. It also had a particular individual, a liberal activist, William Thompson, who was a council housing pioneer. And really, through his own energy and efforts, he was the person almost single-handedly that persuaded Richmond Borough Council to take this on. And it's a small street of council housing, about 64 houses, I think. But fine housing, still in good condition, still well looked after.
So, and I guess we need to deal with this very, very early on. It's not obviously a sexy subject. I mean, if you're somebody who's interested in history and interested in the fabric of London and society more widely, of course it's of massive interest and should be of massive interest. How could we persuade somebody who is thinking about council housing and thinking it's maybe a dreary, identikit housing in quite often rundown areas, how could we persuade them that that's of interest or of relevance?
It's a good question. I think, first of all, given the current housing crisis, social housing does have an enormous role to play. It's part of a mix in terms of owner occupation, private rental, etc. But given our failure to build housing that particularly in London people desperately need, the history and legacy and record and example of council housing is actually still a vitally important and relevant one. More broadly, I'm a social historian, so I think I'm fascinated by the lived experience of ordinary people, and council housing has been an enormous element of that over the last 120 odd years. So in 1981, 770,000 households in London lived in council housing. So it's obviously been something like 32% of the population. In Tower Hamlets, where we're standing now, that figure reached 82%. In Southwark, it was 66%. So anybody with an interest in the lived experience of ordinary Londoners should be interested in council housing. The current figure, 2011 figure, was 440,000 households living in social housing, so that's about 14% of the population, but still obviously a significant proportion.
Mm. And what does that do? I don't know if this is something that you'd be easily able to assess, but what did that do, do you think, to the general mindset? And let's pick a place like the one we're standing in. Upwards of 80% of people in the same situation as regards their home. Does that result in some sort of institutionalisation or a different general mindset? How does that affect how people think about themselves and their lot?
You know, it's very mixed. Council housing isn't homogeneous. It's a huge range of types and forms. And obviously, you know, if we're talking about 770,000 households, we're talking about a huge range of people. So I would really contest any attempt to stereotype, or particularly, as has been a kind of media issue over recent years, to denigrate council tenants.
Oh, good grief. I hope you don't think I was trying to do that. No, I had much more in mind the idea that if you've got everybody with sort of one landlord, basically, then if the landlord makes a change, then everybody's going to feel that change all at once. And I was sort of wondering about the vibe that would produce.
Yeah, well, no, you're quite right to raise it as an issue. And there is an interesting politics around council housing. You used the word institutionalisation, obviously, which I kind of slightly bridle at, but I guess that would have been the perspective of Mrs. Thatcher, for example. When she took office in 1979, she very much had the idea that council housing was problematic, and it was problematic in a couple of ways. One was that she did think it was part of a dependency culture, which stifled enterprise and initiative. She had an ideal of a property-owning democracy. And the second was that she thought that council tenants were disproportionately and for sort of self-interested reasons regarding rents and conditions and so on, Labour voting. So in a sense, and I'm making a good case for Mrs. Thatcher, well, not one that I agree with, but I'm putting her case forward. She, in a sense, she thought that she was liberating council tenants from the sort of benign tyranny of council housing apartments.
There's a row of trees to our right here, just catching the late afternoon sunlight. And off to our left, one, two, three sizable tower blocks. That looks like about 12, 15 stories. There are some lower blocks. They're about four or five stories a piece. And, we're surrounded on all sides, really. And, places like this have a bad rep sometimes, don't they? The term council estate can have particular connotations in people's mind. Is any of it deserved?
There's no doubt that council housing went through a very difficult patch from the 70s into the 80s. And there's no doubt that a particular storyline took hold at that time. It's a very complicated picture. I mean, I certainly record that stuff in the blog. There's no doubt that a lot of even showpiece estates, such as the Cranbrook estate that we're standing in, suffered problems at that time. There was certainly a demonisation, and certainly, you know, without doubt, problems of antisocial behaviour and criminality experienced by some estates. I always put that in a context. I think one school of thought blames council estates, blames the sort of ownership, design, the ethos of council housing. My own research, which is pretty extensive now, I think. I've looked at a lot of estates in London, but up and down the country. Yeah, I very much think that was situational. It was about a moment in time. It reflected a couple of things. Two things were happening at the time. One was that politically, legislation, the 1977 Homeless Persons Act, a labour reform, a well-intended reform, gave priority to certain vulnerable groups, typically single parents, families, people with health issues of various types. That's a very progressive reform, but it did, at a time when less council housing was being built, and even more so into the 80s when there was no council housing being built under Mrs. Thatcher, it did send a message and create, to some degree, a reality that council housing was for the poor, the most poor, and for the most vulnerable. And if you do house a lot of people in a particular area, if you house a lot of, to use the euphemism, vulnerable people in a particular area, you are going to have problems around that. Typically, even in the worst days of council housing, people would always say, tenants would always say, that there were a few problem families. They had a disproportionate impact. They, you know, their antisocial behaviour has a real kind of impact on people's, on the way people live.
Particularly if everybody's so close together. If you put somebody making a big noise in one of these flats, then everyone's going to hear it.
Yeah, although having said that, of course, the flats are always, council housing is almost invariably good quality housing. The build standards are high, the noise insulation is good. So, you know, typically once you close your front door, you're absolutely fine. But certainly there was concerns about public space, shared areas and so on. So there were problems. The other thing I'd say at the time about this sort of the worst days of council housing, if you will, is that it really reflected what was happening within the economy, within society more broadly. It reflected the time when a traditional working class economy was, traditional working class employment was being devastated by, well, I call it Thatcherism for shorthand. Basically, you know, our industrial economy went down the pan. And so council housing, which had, you know, historically council housing had been reserved, not deliberately as such, but had been really the prerogative of a relatively affluent working class, a working class that was employed and could pay their rents. That was a prerequisite that they were expected to be able to pay their rents regularly. So if you look at the long history of council housing, you see it certainly into the 50s, 60s as being housing for a relatively well-off working class. Into the 70s and more so into the 80s, that traditional working class is disappearing. So council housing and estates suffer enormous problems as a result of that economic shift.
Those families presumably aren't ceasing to exist, are they? They might be changing the jobs they're doing, but presumably they're still in need of somewhere to live. I remember back in the 80s, the term single mother was a pejorative. And if single mums are taking some of the flats, where are the families who are changing occupation, where are they going?
Well, I mean, the first thing you have, of course, is enormous waiting lists for council accommodation, and it's only the priority groups, the so-called vulnerable groups, which are being rehoused at this time. So a lot of people, I mean, obviously there is a rise in owner occupation. I don't want to sort of paint a black and white picture. In the 80s, of course, this is diminished since then. But in the 80s, there was a rise in working class owner occupation, so people were buying houses if they were in employment. Otherwise, of course, people were stuck in the private rented sector with not much option of getting out.
You mentioned that the Cranbrook Estate is, I think you said it's a flagship of some sort. So what does the Cranbrook Estate represent?
Well, it represents, in my view, some of the finest council housing built. It's significance, apart from being a good and decent home for many people, is that it was designed by the architect Berthold Lebedkin. It was built by Bethnal Green Borough Council, the local council until 1965, when it became incorporated into town hamlets. And Bethnal Green Metropolitan Borough Council was obviously, given the area, staunchly Labour council, but a progressive council, and one of its priorities was to build good housing for a population which was then, of course, overwhelmingly living in slum terraces. And they were ambitious, as I say, to build well. So they commissioned Berthold Lebedkin, who was an artist engineer. He was a constructivist. He was born in Georgia in witness of the 1917 revolution. He always maintained these socialist principles, always operated by the motto that nothing was too good for the workers. He was the architect of the Finsbury Health Centre, which is a wonderful building built before the war. So Lebedkin, so it's a fine example of Lebedkin's idealism, but also a great example of the energy and idealism of Bethnal Green Metropolitan Borough Council. It's an interesting estate in terms of its design.
Should we describe it a little?
Yeah, let's try and describe it. So what you see, what we can just about see from this vantage point, is, as you pointed out, to begin with, some tower blocks, some point blocks. These are sort of 15-storey to 11-storey, I think. I think there are six of those, if I remember correctly. And there are also four stories of four blocks of four five-storey housing. As I look to my right, I can see sort of two-storey flats. And as I look to my left, we can only see the back of them, unfortunately, but it's one of the most attractive and eye-catching elements, although one of the smallest elements of the estate.
Should we wander around there as we talk?
A series of old people's bungalows. So what you have in all is a wonderfully configured estate in architecturally. It's a very deliberately designed to move from the high rise, which is at the back end of the estate, looking ahead, to the low rise, fronting on Roman Road. The blocks, but incidentally, and it's a good way to see it today, are all angled, so they all catch the sun in different ways. The shadows are sort of constantly moving. And
yes, you don't feel like you're down a canyon, do you?
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, as I say, the overall configuration was absolutely vital to Lebedkin's vision of the estate.
Have you been in one of these?
I haven't been inside, no, which is a shame. Maybe somebody will let me in one day.
Should we pose as vacuum cleaner salesman or something?
Yeah, we could try, couldn't we? And the other element of it, so apart from the very careful overall architectural design, what you also see is a mixed development estate, so-called, which was the kind of big idea of the post-Second World War period. A range of housing types and forms which would suit a range of the population. So that's why you get the tower blocks, but also equally why you get some of the smaller maisonette homes, and particularly the old people's homes. So you have a range of housing to suit a range of needs.
Did we stick a date on this?
We could do, yeah. It started in 55, I think, and it was finished in 1966.
Oh, OK, so this overlaps perfectly with the whole... It doesn't look what I think of as brutalist, but it overlaps with that idea of cities in the sky and all that stuff that was going on at the time.
Yeah, it very much so, actually, because you were talking about kind of people's stereotype of council housing a bit earlier on, and certainly the stereotype, which is another factor, of course, in the negative image that people have of it sometimes, is high-rise. This was in 1955, this was an early example of high-rise. It was high-rise's, excuse the pun, just sort of taking off at the time. And it peaks... another pun. It peaks in 1968. In 1968 is the year which the Roland Point tower in Newham collapses fairly disastrously, four people killed. So that's always taken to sort of symbolically mark the end of high rise. But yes, certainly into 68, something like, I think, I'm trying to remember now, 20, something like 25% of housing was high rise at peak.
I feel like I need to know, because we've talked a little bit about the 50s, we've certainly touched on the 80s, but I feel like we need to cast our line right back to the beginning and see how these developed. You mentioned Richmond.
Yeah.
What was the growth of council housing? How did it establish itself? What sort of housing was it? Who was going in there?
Yeah, well, so Richmond was a slight outlier because it was very rare for a borough council or sort of a local council in that sense to build council housing. But as I said, London County Council, the LCC, was definitely the pioneer of council housing in London, but also as an example across the country. So as I mentioned, the LCC comes into being in 1890. The Boundary Estate is really the first council estate built in the country, opened in 1900.
And that's the one where they bulldozed what was there, basically.
They bulldozed the old nickel, they bulldozed an area of slums, built what are, I think, still very fine-looking tenement blocks. The problem, this refers back to something we were just talking about, the problem with the Boundary Estate was that, in fact, none of the people that lived in the slums could afford to live in the council housing. So although it was theoretically built as to rehouse the slum working class, that simply wasn't financially feasible. I think about 11 people moved from the slums into the new estate, a tiny minority. The slums were kind of dispersed. But it did set a precedent. Something in London, of something around 10,000 council houses were built before 1914, so before the First World War. So you've got the Boundary Estate, you've got Millbank near Tate Britain, which is another fine estate, and a few others dotted around as the major schemes. And what became more typical was just a kind of five-storey walk-up tenements, which is still fairly ubiquitous in London. It's a model that was sort of pursued right into the post-Second World War period.
Presumably the need for council housing is going to shoot up around the time of the First World War.
Yeah, and the massive boost towards to council housing. So up to 1914, council housing had emerged, but it was a fairly kind of a very small scale development, and there was no national impetus. It really depended on the energy and sort of the politics of individual councils. But the First World War makes a huge difference, and is really the start of kind of the story of council housing as we currently understand it. And the significance of the First World War, of course, was A, that it contributed to a massive housing shortage that built up during the war. And there was also that sense, of course, that the working class had to be rewarded for their sacrifice, the sacrifice of life and limb during the First World War. Lloyd George fights the 1918 election on the slogan Homes for Heroes. They also worried, of course, by the threat of revolution. 1917 Moscow, Russian Revolution is a terrible warning of what happens if the working class is too discontented. So council housing emerges in the post-First World War period both as reward and, if you will, as a sort of a pacifier, exactly.
Because the unions were very lively at that time, and Ireland as well.
Yeah, no, it was a period of genuine turmoil. Yeah, very powerful shop steward movement during the war. Trade unionism had risen massively during the war. The Labour Party emerges, although it's still a small party of around 50 MPs, it emerges as the official opposition in 1918. So there is a perceived threat, even if it's not a revolutionary threat. There's a concern that the rise of Labour will threaten the established parties. Lloyd George, as a Liberal, is particularly keen to challenge that. So it's the 1919 Housing Act, which really starts council housing as we kind of understand it today. It not only empowered councils to build council housing, that had been the case from 1890, as I mentioned, but it actually required local authorities to build council housing. So 1919, there are often further Acts of Parliament in the interwar period, but from 1919 through to 1939 in London, something like 119,000 council houses were built. So you have a massive, an exponential increase on the 10,000 built before the First World War.
Oh, we stopped suddenly. To be honest, I was just riding the 20th century now.
Yeah, well, we can carry on with that. So
you're now delivering a lecture, you really.
I know, sorry, it's my I have a teaching background, so I can
so you can do this.
Talk too readily. So the interval period takes you really establishes kind of what became the parameters of council housing through to 1979 essentially, and through to the very changed world of Mrs. Thatcher and the new right. So in the immediate post First World War period, you have a range of very good quality council housing being built. You have one of the most beautiful estates, sticking with London again, is the Dover House estate over in Putney. Arts and crafts inspired cottage suburb, so called. This was the sort of main form of council housing built in the interwar period. But when we think of the so-called cottage suburbs, we're talking about two-storey housing, of course, in this context. When we think of those in London, we probably don't think about Dover House, but we'll think of the massive interwar sites such as Becontree over in Dagenham. Becontree starts in the immediate post-war period. It starts in 1920. It's not really, it's an ongoing project.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
But it's still, by 1939, it has a population of 120,000 living on this enormous estate. That's the largest council estate, probably the largest council estate ever built by most calculations. But you think of Becontree, you can think of the Watling Estate, you can think of Downham and so on. This was the great kind of work of the LCC in the interwar period, primarily these large cottage estates. At the same time, there's a realisation, which again addresses something we talked about earlier, that the cottage suburbs are not suitable for the poorer working class living in the inner city slum areas. They can't afford it, they can't afford the travel costs involved, etc., etc. So in 1930, the Labour government inaugurate the 1930 Housing Act requires that councils redirect their efforts to prioritise the clearance of slum housing and the rehousing of slum population, and that's actually strengthened by the coalition government in 1935. So you do have from the 30s this focus on clearance of slum housing. The Second World War, for obvious reasons, is a pause in this. During the Second World War, all efforts are directed towards victory. So housing, of course, is problematic. There's no new housing to speak of built during the 1945 period.
Slightly less housing night by night, in fact.
Well, exactly. Something like 1 million homes in London were either destroyed or damaged.
Good Lord, as many as that?
During the war. So in 45, it's really, you know, episode two or episode three, perhaps, of the story. Again, of course, you have politically a desire to build a new Britain, but this time much more powerfully, given the Labour landslide in 1945. For the Labour comes to power in 1945 on the slogan, you won the war, now win the peace. That was the famous poster of the Labour Party as it fought that election. So there's very, very much a sense that the sacrifice of war and the kind of popular effort that war represented required a reward in terms of essentially a new and far better housed country in the post-war period.
And I suppose it would be generating much needed employment also.
In terms of rehousing, yeah, I mean, a lot of it. So in the early post-war, post-Second World War years, you're really talking about replacement of housing that had been damaged or destroyed.
But then, okay, so let me just jump in there, because what I think I'm seeing, if I've got this sort of shape in my mind halfway accurate, late Victorian period, we're talking about sort of single innovators getting involved, and that seems to be the signature of the Victorian period right across the picture, not just housing, but all sorts of things, is that you'll have inspirational, inspired individuals rolling up their sleeves and making big things happen. And then between the wars, something a lot more to do with organisation and getting big administrative projects sorted out and providing all sorts of things for masses of people. 60s, it sounds like there was still some of that big vision going on with how people were looking at social housing. And then it all seems to go wrong.
Well, certainly in the 60s, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's from the mid-50s, just to sort of circle back briefly. Basically, the kind of replacement of lost housing is largely complete. So from the mid-50s, there's another drive towards slum clearance and the redevelopment of what we're seeing correctly as very obsolete and run down, Victorian Edwardian terraces. I know these are the houses now that people are spending, paying a million for in London. But there's a real problem, I think, with romanticising the nature of terraced housing, the old working class housing of that period. If you look at the figures, most people were sharing baths, most people had outside toilets, the facilities were poor. So there's very little at the time, very little nostalgic yearning for the housing conditions that they represented. So from the mid-50s, definitely you have this renewed drive, and it goes right through really to the end of the 60s. Massive effort across the political spectrum at the time to rehouse Britain. You talked about the kind of the political vision, if you like, to give you a sense of how the priority given to council housing. In 1963, the Conservative government under Harold Macmillan pledged to build 350,000 houses a year across the country, obviously. The Labour opposition pledges 400,000, then 500,000 houses a year.
Were they delivering on that?
They came close to it at peak in the late 60s. I think approached something like 400,000, I think, at peak. So there was absolutely a sense that housing was really the prime need and almost the most important political issue of the time.
And then, I remember that the 70s, the economy fell flat on its face, and the general impression I get is that from that point on, really the only concern that anybody has is making money, saving money, vilifying anybody in society who's costing us money. And that all of those big visionary projects and those visionaries, I'm not conscious of those.
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on, so it's really hard to kind of capture all the dynamics of what's happening to housing in the 60s, 70s into the 80s. I think to some degree, council housing was a victim of its own success in the 60s. They really did build massively in some areas. The housing shortage was solved. It is a period of relative affluence, so there is, as we mentioned, rising working class owner occupation. So there's a subtle shift. First of all, there's a subtle shift, and that is council housing. Council housing had always been a step up. It had been something that people aspired to. It was, with no shadow of doubt, better housing than most working class people had known.
Really? Because that's something I've never... that's never been on my radar.
No, absolutely, no. I mean, you can look at virtually every estate, and you get these various kind of newspaper interviews at the time, or you get the oral history with people looking back. You know, the times people sort of say what it's like moving into Buckingham Palace. It was, you know, it was heaven with the gates off. That was somebody moving into the Becontree estate. So up to the 60s, there was a sense that council housing was a step up the social ladder. As I say, subtly, that perception shifts into the 60s, into the 70s, as more people are able to buy their own homes. And so council housing shifts slightly from being sort of become slightly less desirable, I suppose, and slightly less aspirational. Into the 70s, there was a kind of, I think there is a backlash against some of the kind of overweening ambition, some of the kind of larger scale developments of the 60s. I mean, you know, there's no doubt. I mean, I'm, as is obvious, I think, a great defender and champion of council housing. But, you know, you can't be blind to the fact that mistakes were made, that some estates weren't well built or well designed, and that simply, you know, on occasion, simply the scale was too overbearing.
Can I just drill into that a little bit? Because I'm very conscious at the moment of this resentment culture that seems to be pervasive. And one could imagine, if you were thinking like that, you might think people who are single parents, these, people coming from abroad and getting a lovely plush estate newly made for them. But it doesn't sound as though actually that's what we're talking about here.
It's not what you're talking about in the 60s, in the 70s, but there is a shift in the 70s. As I said, the legislation is partly responsible for that, because waiting lists grow and those with housing need are prioritised. So there is a resentment.
That's an interesting phrase you use, by the way. Those with housing need, as though there is anybody without housing.
Well, absolutely no. It's quite right to pick me up on that. Those with the most pressing housing needs, those people who really were in some kind of crisis or emergency, were the people overwhelmingly that got housing from 77 onwards. If we want to be controversial, we're in Tower Hamlets. There were tensions around immigration, as it then was, ethnic minority population getting housing. And again, it is the case, you know, you have to understand this and talk about this stuff subtly, you know, to avoid the kind of stereotypes or generalisations. It was the case from 1977 that black and minority populations had hitherto been housed overwhelmingly in the private rented sector, and given their sort of given the discrimination they suffered, almost overwhelmingly in very poor private accommodation. So from the 70s, minority populations previously hadn't been sort of major beneficiaries of council housing because they didn't have sort of long established residency and so on. From the 70s, it is the case that minority populations getting council housing in greater numbers. So there are tensions. There are tensions around, you know, and I'll lapse into the kind of pejoratives of the time, if you will. You know, there were tensions that, as you said, single parents, seen as this, you know, demonised group, jockeys, people with mental health problems and so on, that they were receiving council housing, and people that had been on the waiting list for a long time were effectively excluded from any possibility of council housing. So there is a shift at that time. There is a shift. And, of course, from 1979, with 1980, you have Right to Buy. Mrs Thatcher introduces Right to Buy. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, something like 1.1 million council houses were sold to their tenants in the decade that followed.
What do you think of that?
Right to Buy. Right to Buy is an interesting one. Right to Buy wasn't invented by Mrs Thatcher. The Labour Party actually put it in their 1959 general election manifesto. So there was... and local councils, obviously typically Conservative local councils, had sold off council housing previously. In principle, there's nothing wrong with the right to buy. This is in my personal opinion. And there are issues around mono-tenure. There are issues around sort of very homogeneous populations. Nye Bevan, of course, just going back quickly to the post-Second World War period, Nye Bevan was the Minister of Housing, talked about the living tapestry of a mixed community. His belief was always that if council estates were solely occupied by the sort of poorest in society, that would be very negative, very bad for community, very bad for social cohesion. So there's a positive principle to mixed tenure, and even in that context, to right to buy. The problem, of course, is that Mrs. Thatcher, when it's introduced by the Conservative government in 1980, the problem is that right to buy is it's an ideological weapon. It's designed to effectively destroy traditional council housing. It's part of that kind of demonisation of council housing, council tenants that you've raised. And the problem with council housing specifically was with right to buy, as it was implemented in the 1980s, is that as these council houses, these 1.1 million council houses were being sold, virtually none were being built to replace it.
Oh, right, and that would differ from when it first mooted in 1959, because at that point they're competing to build houses.
Well, absolutely, and the sense was that, you know, if councils were getting receipts from council house sales, that was money that could be ploughed into building new houses for people on the waiting list, for people that needed homes. Mrs. Thatcher specifically prohibited local authorities spending the receipts from right to buy. No new council housing was built in the 1980s. Her idea was a property-only democracy. She believed council estates, council tenants were sort of benighted communities.
But that doesn't make any sense, does it? Because what we've talked about, or just in sketching the history of housing in London, slums, often privately owned, and terrible private rented conditions, and I guess we see now, I can think of plenty of adverts on Gumtree for housing. I wouldn't go within a mile of those. I'd much sooner have a look at one of these flats just here.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I'm sure there's a lot of people in the private rented sector that would be very, very happy to get a council house or council home of some sort. And the irony, of course, with right to buy, if we're thinking in the London context, is that 30% of former council homes which were originally purchased by tenants have now been sold on and are now in the private rented sector. And in some cases, which is the kind of utter lunacy of the current politics, in some cases, in quite a few cases, those...
Please don't tell me the council is paying for council tenants to move into the private places.
Yes, the council is either, you know, sometimes it's directly renting them, or alternative, of course, what we're doing is paying housing benefit. I mean, the irony, of course, is that... We're spending massively on housing, but the form that we're choosing to spend it in the moment is not in terms of actually bricks and mortar building houses for people that need them, but actually paying housing benefit to private landlords. It's a massive waste of resources. It's a massive diversion of state income and revenue to private landlords. I'm not slacking off for every private landlord, of course, and we need a private rented sector. I'm not sort of making that kind of sweeping generalisation, but in terms of the kind of cost benefit, it's a ludicrous equation.
There's a name that's been lurking in the back of my brain while you've been talking, and it's a name that I've heard so many times. I don't know whether this person is going to be relevant to the conversation. Who was Rackman?
Oh, Rackman, yeah. Well, Rackman was, I believe it's in Notting Hill, isn't it? I think, I believe, a landlord in Notting Hill. And
when are we talking?
We're talking 50s, 60s. Yeah, he was a notorious slum landlord who used fairly unorthodox, well, let's say fairly criminal methods in order to sort of shift tenants in and out of his properties to maximise his profits. Very low-quality private rented housing, of course, but... at scale. The irony about Rackman, just to be sort of balanced about this, is that he did at a time when, you know, the cliche, and I won't use the word, but the posters went up in windows, sort of saying, you know, no Irish, no blacks, no dogs. Apparently, there was heavy discrimination against minority populations who needed housing in the private sector. Rackman would rent to anybody. So for that reason, given the kind of, you know, not only was it low quality housing, it tended to be overcrowded housing because people were kind of crowding in to, you know, a relatively confined section that they were open to.
He sounds a delight.
he I don't think it was a delight, no. He was a product of his time, I guess.
We've just got a few minutes left to, I suppose, try and bring ourselves... We're mostly located in the present now, I guess, with councils sending their needy people off to private landlords and paying big bucks for it. What else can we say about the trends in council housing? Are they suffering the same sort of fate as housing generally in London? In other words, not being built.
First thing, I'll track back first of all, because we spend a lot of time and talking about sort of council estates, council housing as problematic, as being in poor condition or certainly poorly regarded. The new Labour government, which came in 1997, was also unsympathetic to council housing, i.e. housing owned and managed by local authorities.
It was unsympathetic?
Unsympathetic, yes, very much so.
I thought that was a government full of compassion.
Well, the Labour government shared an antipathy towards council housing apartments and their management and ownership. They were more sympathetic to social housing, so this would have a sort of shift in the jargon, but also a shift in the form at this time. Mrs. Thatcher didn't build council housing, but there was a move to build far more housing under the aegis of housing associations. So nowadays when we talk about social housing, we're talking about housing which is overwhelmingly either some is still directly owned and managed by councils, a large proportion is owned and managed by housing associations. So what you have in the 80s under Mrs. Thatcher, but this is actually a policy which is pursued even more strongly by New Labour, is the transfer of council housing to new what they call registered social landlords. And these were either housing associations or, in some cases, the sort of hived-off housing departments now operating as kind of semi-independent entities. So that's one major shift. Social housing is with us. It's still important, as I said. A lot of people in London still live in social housing. Social housing is being built, not in the numbers that we need, but it is being built. And, of course, even today, as we speak, Sadiq Khan's announced the sort of new London rules on affordable housing. That's the sort of the other game in town at the moment, affordable housing, which is a very problematic phrase. At worst, affordable housing was defined by the Conservative government as 80% housing rented at 80% of market rent, which is not affordable to most people in housing need.
No, even people on decent money.
No, it's a ludicrous figure. It's completely unfeasible. I know Sadiq Khan is talking about the London living rent, which I think is supposed to be one third of sort of average earnings. So there are moves. The other sort of element in the mix of so-called affordable housing is, you know, shared ownership, rent to buy, etc., etc. What we had into the 60s and 70s, well, you know, through the story of council housing up to 79 is a pretty simple model. You know, essentially you have subsidies from central government, council borrowing in order to build housing. You know, the word subsidy is probably a flawed word in the context, because these were grants which were always paid off. So council housing, by and large, has paid for itself time and time again over the years. And of course, people paid, you know, realistic rents. But post 79, you have a very different model, and essentially looking to a much more complex system of funding, use of private capital, etc., etc. What I did want to say, in reference to the sort of negative image that council housing acquired historically, is that New Labour, although it was very unsympathetic towards council landlords as such, did invest in very significant improvements, decent homes, the so-called decent home standards. So if you look at council housing, or social housing, as we should call it, from this period. If you look at social housing, you've got most estates now. There's been massive investment. There's been really significant improvements. You can see it in terms of the general quality of the homes and facilities. You can certainly see it in the landscaping and upkeep. So, you know, I visit a lot of council estates. It's very rarely that, you know, I have any impression whatsoever that, you know, these are unattractive places, that these are undesirable places. Council housing, currently social housing, it remains good quality housing, as it always has been, but it remains, to my eyes, and I think to the eyes of most people that live in it, attractive, decent housing. What I would say is that, you know, in conclusion, I guess, is that politically, we're unfortunately living in a time where there is an antipathy towards social housing, towards public housing, But in terms of the current housing crisis as part of the mix, it remains as vital today as it ever has been.
I've got one final question. This could put a different spin on everything you said. I don't know. It might not at all. It might underscore it. But it's clear where you're coming from on the principle of or the principles of council housing. Have you ever lived in a council house?
No.
Intriguing.
I mean... that's an interesting question. I'm always prepared for that question, although slightly underprepared as you ask it to me. Just ask it me just now. I think it's hard to. I mean, Britain is a very class-ridden society. So if you want to, I can place myself in class terms very precisely. I come from a pretty fairly humble but lower middle-class background. So my dad owned a house, bought a house. That's my particular heritage, if you will. Council housing has been predominantly working class housing. I'm not working class, but I am a historian of the working class, and I'm proud to record that history.
Yeah, and I wouldn't, just in case there's any sense in which a listener might perceive me to be debarring you from being an expert on the subject, I think if we were talking to somebody about Roman history, we wouldn't expect them to be Roman.
No. So, I think that's fair enough. Yeah.
Where can people read more? Because you're a prolific blogger. Where can people read more?
Yeah, thank you. It's a quick plug. So Municipal Dreams, one word, municipaldreams.wordpress.com. You'll find me there. And I'm always really interested to hear from people who live in council housing or who have recorded a local history. I'd like the blog to be seen as a resource for this broad history in London and across the country, so I'd be delighted to hear from people.
As would we. And from an increasingly chilly, I've got to say, the sun's gone away and it is parky. So from an increasingly chilly Cranbrook estate, John Bowden, thanks very much.
Thank you. Good talk.
My heart aches for some far off place. No one could have left you with your name, how you raised us. Love's fake.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to John Bowden. Thanks to Sue Sinton-Smith and to Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.